Today is May 2nd, 2005, and sorry we were late a little bit this morning because the Republican members were in caucus, and with that, and House the Committee on Trade and Economic Development will come to order. And the first item, and I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3063.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3063, you heard on the 20th of April, it authorizes the Oregon Department of Agriculture to assist in the construction and operation of livestock quarantine facilities designed to qualify disease-free livestock for export. Original bill appropriates $8 million in general fund. You have the Dash 1 amendment that changes the bill to a feasibility study for the proposed quarantine facility and appropriates $75,000. I have copies of the Dash 1 if anyone.
Okay, let's distribute the Dash 1 amendment. And do we have any person you'd like to testify on this bill? Okay. Coy Coward, the president of Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and please come forward. Thank you very much for coming and appreciate it. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Coy Coward. I'm president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'd like to testify on behalf of this bill. And briefly, if I could, I'll tell you the way it was, the way it is, and the way it could be. The cattle industry in the state of Oregon is relatively successful at this time, but the infrastructure of the industry is almost non-existent. And, of course, that's pretty varied, the infrastructure. Such things as quarantine facilities, which would allow us to ship cattle out of the country, cattle or other animals such as racehorses, various other things. There are no quarantine facilities in the state of Oregon, only one in the state of Washington, and I'm not even aware of any in the state of California. So we're looking actually at the West Coast that this particular facility could service if we had one. The industry itself, the state of Oregon used to be the hub of the cattle industry west of Greeley, Colorado. This wasn't too awful many years ago. But because of losing the infrastructure that keeps it healthy and alive, such as even down to little things like a place to wash out a cattle truck, there are no places in the state of Oregon that are legally you are allowed to wash out your cattle truck. I just received a $450 fine on a semi coming out of the state of California, which I owned, because I had a leaking sifting load. So those things go on, and without the infrastructure, it's going to be very difficult for us to continue to grow. I believe it was in the 40s. We were still extremely healthy. Portland Auction Yard, at a commission yard at that time, was selling hundreds of thousands of cattle out of the state of Oregon. And cattle were coming from as far away as Nevada, Northern California, Montana. They were even driving cattle in here from Montana up in the 20s to Portland, to then go on to the packers and to the slaughterhouses. So we've lost all of those slaughterhouses. There are very few of those left. There's only about 15 USDA-inspected plants left in the state of Oregon. They're very small, and most of them are custom kill, even though they are USDA-inspected. We've lost our quarantine facilities. We've lost the washouts. We've lost feedlots. We've lost auction yards. In Willamette Valley, in the last 10 years, we lost 50,000 head of cattle right in Willamette Valley. Now, true, most of these went to Eastern Oregon, and we still are raising them, but we lost them here. When I purchased Lebanon Auction Yard in 1987, there was 11 auction yards in Western Oregon, and now there's three. So you can see that our infrastructure is dying. These quarantine facilities, there used to be two of them in the state, in Portland. They're not there. Recently, we sent 750 cattle, 950-pound steer and heifers to South Korea. That was just before the mad cow incident, and we had a terrible time finding a place that we could do as a makeshift quarantine and export facilities. Finally, we wound up at the Dalles auction yard. The owner was gracious enough to let us come in with some tents and cover that. One of the requirements is the facilities must be covered, and it must have a hard floor, and you must be able to feed and water and take care of the animals properly and make sure that they're healthy before they go. So we set up a tent over some concrete pins, brought in some portable facilities, and it was a makeshift deal that cost the exporter, actually the importer into Korea, it cost him an additional $40,000 simply because we did not have a place to load the cattle. $40,000 for that one loan. Now, he has told us, and also the Oregon Department of Ag, that he'd love to have another 10,000 head of cattle coming in to South Korea as soon as the border opens from the mad cow thing, but he doesn't want them coming in if it costs him an additional $40,000 a load. So we are really kind of poised in Oregon to take command of the export on the West Coast. Even Washington State is not interested in running their export facilities anymore, but there's going to be a tremendous need, I think, in the next 10 years, simply because of world trade. China, when China comes in the market, 1.3 billion people, and I'm telling you, they're getting richer. They're going to have Oregon beef. They're going to have American beef. And I think that beef should be coming through our facilities in Oregon as opposed to coming out of Illinois or one of those other places. We almost entered into a contract. We were just right on the verge of entering into a contract to furnish 1,000 head of Holstein heifers to China. And the thing that put a stop to it, of course, would be mad cow. So I think that Oregon could, again, take command as the exporting state on the West Coast to all of the Rim Nations for cattle, for horses, inner Mongolia, outer Mongolia are needing cattle. They want to go from the goat that they've raised for all these years. Goats and sheep, they would like to go to cattle simply because goats and sheep eat all of the little trees and all of the foliage, everything, and cattle doesn't do that. We just recently entertained a group of those folks, and I believe I brought them to your committee, and you introduced them. We appreciate that. But those folks were pretty impressed with some of the things that we had. We sent them all over the state of Oregon. They're very impressed with the bloodlines, and it looks like that they would like to buy some purebred seed stock. And, of course, that has to go through quarantine facilities. And if we don't have the facilities, we're not going to be able to enter into the market. So I would encourage you to pass this bill, and I commend whoever wrote it. It wasn't me. But it's something that the state of Oregon needs. We need it desperately. And I thank you very much for your time. And if there are questions, I'd be delighted to answer them.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And are you familiar with the Dash 1 amendment we have?
No, I am not.
Okay,
sir.
And as Jim explained, the Dash 1 amendment is just a study for the next until. When is the study completed? By October 1st, 2006, next year. And with that, we shall be able to move on with the plan that we are going to have. Instead of moving ahead, this national amendment substitutes the current bill completely. Okay. Can you comment on it?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for allowing me to comment. And ladies and gentlemen, I think this is a good amendment and probably the way to go. The only suggestion I would have is I'd certainly like to be on this committee, if at all possible.
Yes. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes. Representative Bellum.
Yes, Glenn. We're just looking at the Dash 1 amendment from $8 million down to $75,000. And I hear from your side of the podium and on my side, I feel a sense of urgency to get into the midterm race. Is that sense of urgency justified, or should it cool in the wheels?
Chairman Lynn, Representative Dolam, I think you're absolutely right. The urgency is there. I don't know exactly when this border is going to open, but when it does, we should be poised and ready to go, the state of Oregon. And I think your urgency is well put.
Follow up. Then with an $8 million draw on the general fund, has the cattleman looked into anything that might be able to repay a bond? I'm thinking in terms of the checkoff system or something like that. Is there any way that the cattlemen have looked at perhaps coming alongside and doing part of this? I want to go now.
Chairman Lynn, Representative Dolam, no, they have not. There are some other things that we're doing that I've never done before, such as trying to increase the dollar checkoff in the state of Oregon by an additional 50 cents. We have a bill, I believe, that's in the process right now, and most of that money has been earmarked for some things at Oregon State. But we are proactive, and this will be the first time in the history of the cattle industry in the state of Oregon that I know about that anybody has ever even tried to appropriate some money from the industry itself to help themselves. And I will not be the president after November of this year, but the incoming president is just as proactive and aggressive as I am, and I think you're going to see a big change in the industry in the state of Oregon to help ourselves.
Vice Chair Mulkey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. The question I have, I support this Dash 1 amendment, and certainly I think the study will be very useful. But the question I have is, what you describe sounds like a classic market opportunity in a capitalist country. If this large demand is expected, why isn't there entities, corporations or individuals or associations that want to step in and fill this need, create this, as you say, covered hard floor facility to serve the market in this way? Why? I guess I'm asking the question, if this path is followed and this study says it's needed, why should it be government that puts up the money rather than it being an investment opportunity in a market economy?
Mm-hmm. Chair Lynn and Representative Mercury, you're absolutely right. But if you bear with me just a moment, we're talking about world trade, and I guess the market for almost everything is the United States of America at this time, including the consumption of beef. All of these large companies are trying to buy the product as cheaply as they can or manufacture the product as cheaply as they can, and that doesn't mean in the United States of America. It means somewhere else. And we want to bring that product from someplace else to here. We, at this time, China may overcome us, but at this time, the United States of America is the consuming public for beef. So there probably is 15 new slaughter facilities on the drawing board to be built in Canada, just across the border. They can get it done. They're highly subsidized by their government there for these type of facilities. In fact, a huge amount of that money for building each one of these slaughter facilities will be coming from their federal government. Not true in the United States. It's private industry. So our private industry is going up there and taking advantage of those large grants from the government, and in some cases the government is building slaughter facilities and then leasing it to these large corporations. The large corporations get tax breaks, huge tax breaks, for coming to Canada instead of building them here in the United States. So that is the reason why that you see not a lot going on as far as new facilities or infrastructure in the United States. As long as they're allowed to, they're going to go somewhere else where the labor is cheap, the environmental laws are very not as strenuous as they are in the United States, in the state of Oregon, and that's where they're going to build these, and they're going to bring all the product. And that, to me, that's a security issue. I'm nervous about this. I've been talking for the last 10 years. I can't get anyone to see my side of it. Mm-hmm. These products that are coming in from China, the textile industry has been almost destroyed. The beef industry is going to be exactly the same way. We're actually the only industry that has been able to kind of hold our own. And we still are at this time, but if they shift all of these slaughter facilities to Canada, it's going to be extremely difficult for us in the United States to compete worldwide in this particular industry.
Thank you for that international picture to frame what's going on here in Oregon and Suffolk. It sounded to me in the slaughter facilities, you're talking primarily about the importation of animals. Would these quarantine facilities or this quarantine facility be useful for quarantining of imported livestock, or is it primarily an export?
Exactly. Yes, sir.
For imports as well.
Representative Lynn, Representative Murky, yes. It depends upon the federal government and their specification for quarantine. They tell us, you know, what conditions we have to meet. And in a few years back, must have been about 15 years back, 20 years maybe, a lot of sheep came in from New Zealand, and they were quarantined right here in Portland, mm-hmm. out on one of the islands, I believe it was, for quite a long time. And that was a recognized federal quarantine facilities. Mm-hmm. If you had to bring in any of that now, any animals, and they had to be quarantined, I don't know where you would put them. Mm-hmm. I just really don't.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it of any concern that we're possibly creating our own competition by seeding the herds in Asia at this point?
Representative Graham, Representative Riley, no.
Okay.
I think the answer is pretty straightforward. At this point, there's 1.3 billion Chinese, I believe, figures. I've heard a number of figures, but there's a lot of them. And they are getting richer very quickly. Mm-hmm. I've entertained a lot of them at my house, and they're a lot richer than I am, let me tell you. But it looks to me like, and the statistics that I'm finding, is that it would take in the neighborhood of 30 years for the Chinese to even feed themselves with anything, that any live cattle or anything we export to them. Their dairy industry is almost non-existent. However, they've expressed to us they'd like to buy 10,000 head of Holstein dairy cattle. No way we could. We just couldn't furnish that many. I don't know where that's going to come from. But we can furnish them some. And so it's going to take a long time for them to build their infrastructure as well. They have none. They are building a lot of facilities. The Oregon Department of Ag has brought me back a number of videos that show like 2,000 head dairies that they're building, and they're real nice. In fact, we are assisting them with data from Oregon State, from the Oregon Department of Ag, and from our industry. They asked for assistance. So that was my first concern, but I believe that it'll be from 30 to 50 years before they can actually build the infrastructure to feed themselves and then be competitive with us. Does that answer your question, sir?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, I'm a bit concerned about even needing this Dash 1. We already know all that. And I'm just wondering why, I think we have to seize the opportunity when it's here. And it is here. It was here 2 years and 4 years ago, as a matter of fact. So I'm curious why we'd want to wait till 2006. There are economic dollars, development dollars available. And the number of individuals that we would employ is great, and we need it. So do we really want this Dash 1 amendment? I can't see anything in it we don't already know.
Chairman Lamb, Representative Nelson, I would much rather see the bill. However, I cannot give you the information at this time where we should put this facilities, and so the amendment may help determine where we would like to have it. Now, I didn't have a chance really to read the amendment. It was pointed out by my executive director that it's we were looking for $75,000 as opposed to me looking at October 2006, and you're absolutely right. When the opportunity is there, I agree with you 100%. Seize the opportunity. It costs a lot less money when you can seize the opportunity when it's in front of you. So I'm in agreement with you. I believe that the border to beef exporting out of the United States will probably be open before the year is out. And someone is going to be in the middle of this. China does need those Holstein heifers. They need them desperately. They are going to have even beef. So I agree with you. I'm not in favor of putting it off, but I'd rather have this than nothing.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow up.
The amendment does not speak to location at all. So regardless, with or without this amendment, we're going to have to determine locations. I offer up Yamhill County. And not the Dalles. Sorry, excuse me, but I think that can be done. You know, it's no different than establishing the other type of business. I mean, you get businessmen together and you get going. And so that doesn't even, location isn't even part of the amendment. I recommend we go forward with the primary bill. Because we need the employment, we need the economic dollars, and we should not wait.
Representative Donna Nelson, I agree with you 100%, but again, I apologize for not seeing the amendment. I didn't even know there was an amendment until I'd already sat down at the chair, so I didn't get to read everything that it says, but you're absolutely right. I would wholeheartedly agree that it's time to move forward. And we've got a lot of plans here that's going to help us. Besides the legislature, I consider the legislature my best friend in the cattle industry, the Oregon Department of Ag, and OSU. That's our best friend. And they're all seem to be on the bandwagon with us on this one. I think everybody can recognize the opportunity for world trade, and we've been on the short end of the stick on this world trade thing for a long, long time. Those containers coming into Seattle and to Portland have been thousands of them, but we're not sending many back the other way.
That's right.
So if we're going to compete worldwide, we're going to have to add value to our dollar in every way that we can. And this course would be if we had a facility, so Oregon could export cattle as well as horses. South Korea is really using a lot of racehorses. And it's difficult to do these makeshift things. We need facilities that, first of all, you can be proud of, and secondly, one that will give us what we need. I just toured the new veterinarian school building at Oregon State Saturday. Chairman Lynn, and you need to look at that. You guys have provided this money. I think it was about $17 million, and it's very, very good. The only complaint that I had, that there was no place to put a cow. It was only dogs and cats. And it's beautiful, and I would encourage you guys to get the opportunity to look at. So, again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
May I ask one more question?
One more question, please.
I would just like to offer up the PEMCO building at Portland. It's ready to go. We could use it. It would, I mean, with adaptability, the state paid, you know, huge sums for that. The employees' benefit program is invested heavily, $50 million of state employees' retirement and other funds are in there, sitting there. It's huge. It's adaptable, ready to go. And I mean, if we wanted to do something really good for the state right now, we'd also take that building off their hands. I understand the Oregon Guard could use a portion of it, and this we could benefit the state substantially as well as the economy.
Chairman Lynn, Representative Nelson, I'm not aware of the building, but I will make myself aware of it, and I will contact both of you folks in your committee later and, you know, see what we can do about this. Very good suggestion. Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Dallam?
Just one, Australia, Argentina, Canada, those would be our 1, 2, 3 number one competitors. For cattle.
Chairman Lynn, Representative Dahlem, it depends upon the trade agreements in how they sign these things. And South America could enter into this thing bigger than all of them.
With those competitors, how many of those competitors provide government-sponsored quarantine facilities?
Chairman Lynn, Representative Dahlem, I can't answer that because I haven't been to all those nations. I've been to some of them, and some of them do, but I haven't been to Australia, so I can't tell.
Which one? Does Australia?
I'm sure that they do because they have the laws that we have to conform to as well. So common sense dictates that they must all do it.
What I'm looking for, what I'm going with this is we have competitors that are set up and ready to go, and it seems to me the first foot into the market is usually the best foot into the market, and I do feel a sense of urgency to revive Oregon's cattle industry to what it can be. I don't want to spend a lot of time looking back. The Dash 1 Amendment troubles me. The original bill troubles me because of the size, but when I think of the potential that this state could realize from exporting and exporting from the West large quantities of cattle to the Far East, I think we should seize this opportunity.
Right. Any other questions?
All right.
And I believe it is an urgency. We do as we can, but since there are so many unknowns, I think it's appropriate. We have studies done, the locations, and the study the facilities in Washington State, how they operate that, and how could we maximize our places to export our product. And there are so many unknowns. I believe that the Dash 1 is the appropriate way to get this done. So that we are going to do that. So I do appreciate your time. And also, as a chair of this committee, I also thank you very much offering yourself to be the member of the study committee. Certainly, I'd like to encourage and recommend you to be the member of this study committee.
Thank you very much,
ladies and gentlemen. So, in our hand, we have a Dash 1 amendment. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3063.
And Vice Chair Bruin and to move Dash 1 amendment to adopt the Dash 1 amendment to the House Bill 3063. Is there any objection to...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Yes, I do object. I agree with Representative Dahlem and Hart Coward, we know all of these already. We know the market demand. There are engineering designs and construction costs already established. We know who needs to participate. We know where some funding is, and, you know, we're here to promote and move business, not delay like, you know, has happened here on, in the timber industry for so long, and now it's going to burn up. But I'll just mention this from having been in the business that transports these animals, you know, having been a horse shipper, bull shipper, chicken shipper, you know, all of those over many years. If we couldn't fly them, somebody else immediately stepped in, and it was UPS and the FedExes, and look what happened. So I just think we're really messing with a great opportunity to move forward now, and having entertained a number of these individuals from Korea over the past 4 years, they like us now, and I'm hating, even I'm a Texan, I hate for Texas beef or Nebraska beef to move in ahead of us, so that is my objection. I'll be voting no.
That will be noted, and then if we build this, how much is it going to cost? Any idea?
No, I asked for the quarantine protocol so that we might get some notion that I do have some people looking at it, but $8 million is not out of line at all.
Okay. But since even we do not know how much will it cost, because of the reason, I think we need some kind of study and research. And without some guidelines and without knowing the facts, just go ahead and do it. I don't think that is the best interest for this community and for the state, even cattle industry. So we don't want to mistake on it, and we are going to bring the professionals, and then we are going to map out how we're going to do it. So with that, and please call the roll, anyone that's members that the support the Dash 1 amendment, say aye. For those opposed, say no.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Dallin.
I'm going down the two. Aye. Didn't take much of a vote count.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Nay. Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair Lim.
Aye.
One amendment adopted, and then do we have a subsequent referral to the OAC means?
We do, yes.
We do have a subsequent referral to the of this 3063. And do we have a motion to move this bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3063 as amended to the House Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Bruin moves the House Bill 3063 to the Ways and Means as the amended. And any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Since I'm put in a very awkward situation, but I think we should move forward immediately on this bill. I'll be voting no, and that's my reason why. I don't think we need to delay.
All right. Thank you very much for your comment. And the members in support of this House Bill 3063 as amended, say aye. Those opposed, say no. And please call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Dallin.
Aye.
Representative Merkley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Nay.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Chair Nelson. Chair Lim.
You take over. Okay, Chair Lim say aye. Okay. And so House Bill 3663 is passed. And do you need to close the work session on this bill?
Yeah, we'll close the work session.
I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 3063, and then I'll open again. What do I need? Enterprise zone? Open. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3143.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3143, you've heard several times before, this eliminates the limitation on the number of enterprise zones that may be designated by the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. It eliminates economic hardship requirements for enterprise zones, and it eliminates 10-year limitation on enterprise zone designation. Last time we handed out several amendments, and you actually adopted the Dash 4, is my recollection. So the Dash 4 is currently on this bill. The Dash 4 restores the current provisions on enterprise zones. It adds up to 10 enterprise zones that the Economic and Community Development Department may designate. It increases the number of possible enterprise zones from 49 to 59, and in addition, it includes an opt-out provision for special districts.
Okay, and
Doris is here.
Yes.
And Doris is here. Could you give us the your the proposal of the amendment? And please explain to us what's the differences and why do we need this new proposal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell from Association of Oregon Counties. And in an attempt to try to find a way to increase slightly enterprise zones on behalf of the Eugene Metro Partnership and others that are likely to request zones because they have some opportunity for economic development. I decided with discussions with the special districts in a minor way and with the cities and the department that it might be helpful if we had some other options before us in order to be sure you're taking into account any special costs to either the cities or the counties or the service districts if there is some major project within an enterprise zone. I talked to the chair of the committee, I believe on Thursday, and we decided that it might be helpful to do this, and so I gave to legislative council a proposal like this. Reduce the number of enterprise zones that would be increased to 5, and if you wanted it 1, 2, 3, 4, that would be fine too. In addition to that, in an enterprise zone, if a business chooses to select the 3 to 5 option, from 3 years to 5 years, or the extended abatement period in an enterprise zone, and that's usually a business that's a larger business, provide that the zone sponsor actually, in an agreement with the sponsor, try to find some way to pay for a portion of those costs to be sure that the services can be provided, whether they be infrastructure, utilities, extra fire control, water, sewer, whatever it may be, and have that put in the statute in a more specified way than it is now. Currently, the enterprise zones do allow for some kind of discussion like this, but it doesn't specify in any major way how that is done. It's my understanding in talking to several zone managers that, in fact, when they have a business that's going into an enterprise zone and they're requesting the extended abatement, and that's at the beginning of the period, they go through this process now, and I think there are examples all over the state where that takes place. We do actually have a zone manager here in the audience today. Well, we have a couple of them in the audience today that might be able to tell you how that works now. But we did not get this amendment back from Legislative Council, so I don't have it in front of me, and I don't know the specific wording.
Well, any questions? If not, and Art, could you comment on that? The comment on this possible amendment.
Art Fisher's here.
Okay.
Thank you again, Chair Lim. For the record, my name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Chair Lim, members of the committee. Doris, I think, fairly explained the option that was developed as an attempt to bridge the gaps or whatever in matters here. And what it would do is sort of specify something that I think, as Doris has rightly corrected, told you, is not uncommonly done. When a company is going to go from the usual, you know, straight up, very simple 3-year exemption and get a couple more years, there's really two requirements. One, they have to pay this very high compensation level to begin with, and I don't, you know, it's hard, but it's also something that I think, as we talked about the first time, a lot of big projects are using. And secondly, they have to have a written agreement between the zone sponsor and the business. Okay, and in that written agreement, these amendments would, you know, and I'm paraphrasing because also, of course, we don't have the agreement, but the sponsor and the business would be specifically directed to address any real direct impacts from the project on services, public services, you know, to the extent they exist. You know, not all districts or services would be necessarily impacted by a given facility, but to the extent they are, that would be taken into account as far as the, quote, local additional requirements that are, you know, can go into those types of agreements. And I have seen it in the past with the city of Springfield was one of the first to an extent abatement, and they had some additional money contributed by the company for police and fire, or I think mainly police services. I believe with the Cardinal facility, we were going to hopefully have the zone manager from Hood River here because we ran into him on Friday or Thursday with Ways and Means, and they had with the Cardinal facility, they addressed these very same issues as well, as far as negotiations that happen with that extended abatement. So we thought, you know, that would be a good opportunity at the local level with some local flexibility and so forth maintained for actual real impacts and monies to be addressed, as opposed to, you know, something that is sort of rigid and, you know, creates a you know, a disconnect, I think, between what might be a real public service impacts and the effects happening through an enterprise zone. So with that, I would just urge you to maybe hear from one of the local zone managers we have here just for your edification and so forth. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I'd like to call at this time, I'd like to hear a comment from the lady, Klasa? Okay. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Senator Lim, and members of the committee. My name is Larry Glasick. I am the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation, located in Salem, and we cover both Marion and Polk County. I am also the manager of the Salem Enterprise Zone, and have been so since, I think, 1989. So I've been around enterprise zones for a good number of years, seen a lot of changes. Actually, I'm here to talk about the opt-out provision. You understand that enterprise zones were created to make Oregon more competitive, and this is really a competitive society we live in, not only to help existing companies stay and expand and employ more people, but also to recruit new businesses into this area. We're competing with other states that have different types of incentive programs, as well as other cities that maybe add on to those. I think the opt-out idea is just a bad idea. I remember we dealt with this when the enterprise zone legislation was approved, I think, in 1987, and a couple of other legislative terms this issue has come up again. It creates, you know, if the opt-out idea was adopted, it would create a whole bunch of different classes of enterprise zones. I don't know how many special districts there are around the state, but I know within our area, we probably got 6 or 7. Like I said, and the other thing is it erodes the integrity of the enterprise zone. Once you start chipping away at it, you're going to lose it. And we have lost a lot of our incentives here in Oregon to help businesses stay and grow and to get new companies in. The other thing we have to be concerned about is the increasing the cost of government. Not only does this make the enterprise zone provisions more complex, more difficult to administer, but that's going to also increase the cost throughout the area. So we just need to make sure that well, we understand who the client is. The client is the companies and the people that we hope that they're going to employ. So I would urge you not to to adopt the opt-out provisions. I think in dash 4, it's section 4 and paragraph 7A of section 5. I just saw it this morning, so I went through it very quickly. So that's what I would have to say about that. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions?
So we have a question?
Yes. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, if I may. You mentioned two things that concern me. First of all, I'm a little concerned about the small special districts who are barely making it now, and taking any revenue away from those special districts so that they are not able to meet their obligations. And I wanted to know what you thought about that. But secondly, you mentioned at the end the cost of government. And, of course, if we didn't have enterprise zones at all, we'd have less cost of government. So I don't think that's a really sound argument. But what do you think about those two things, if you will?
Well, I'm certainly sympathetic with the financial plight of the special districts. But one of the basic fundamentals of the enterprise zone is, had it not been for the enterprise zone, that company would have not come to that area or had expended as much money as they would to develop it. So it's money they wouldn't have had, possibly would have not had anyway. So the enterprise zone, unlike the strategic investment program, is only for a 3 to 5 year period. So that money then will come back to those people, to the special districts as those expire. I think the vast majority of enterprise zone approvals are probably for 3 year. I know in the Salem enterprise zone since 1989, I think we've only had one 5 year enterprise zones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much. You just heard some testimony concerning the idea of a yet another amendment that would allow for some flexibility in terms of negotiation, or at least clarify. Could you tell me, in your experience, have there been situations in your enterprise zone where a company has opted, as you just mentioned, it's very rare, for the five-year option, and was there any negotiating with the special districts as part of that, or to address a particular need that a small district might have that was actually providing a service for a company that was coming in and was costing that special district?
Chairman Lambert, Representative Buckley, I'm not comfortable with the amendment for that provision that has been discussed here. As I recollect, the existing law provides that the cities or sponsors for extended provision may negotiate other extractions. And so it leaves it open to them to do that rather than having it mandatory. Now, I know that this has occurred in some other areas. In my area, no. Like I said, the only five-year exemption that we have done was for Sumco when they did their $400 or $500 million expansion. And that was in the early 90s when we were negotiating that. We were just coming out of recession and 12% unemployment, and we saw the benefit of putting 1,000 people to work as well as the tax revenues out of that to help fund a lot of infrastructure, plus a million gallons of water a day was sufficient.
And Mr. Chair, are we going to hear from the special district's representative?
Yes. All right. No more questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Jack, can I get your comment on this issue? This looks like a more complicated than I expected.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the director of the Lane Metro Partnership, and yeah, we sort of started all this working with Representative Bruin, saying, wouldn't it be nice to, if anyone who wanted an enterprise zone could get it. Now, as we're talking about, can we just increase the number? And as Representative Dellum knows, that is not an academic issue right now. We have currently two spots that are open and three communities that are competing for them. Two of them are ones that have had them before, including Madras and also Harrisburg, Junction City. Eugene's trying to compete for that. We wanted to do it because we thought it was a good idea. We now know that there's a greater sense of urgency since last week we talked to a company that is interested in making a $5 million investment and 100 jobs here in the natural foods industry. They've just entered into a strategic alliance with a national company, and they don't know if they can meet the capacity here or they have to move to California. So this is not just an academic exercise. We don't have a real dog in the fight on the opt-out or not the opt-out, but I will, at the risk of making some enemies here, give you my personal opinion about this. Having been a county commissioner, I have a little bit of background. I know how jealously local governments guard their prerogatives, but I would also tell you that any city or county that wants an enterprise zone that can't convince the special districts that it's good for them probably ought to rethink their strategy. I think the issue that my friend Larry Glassick just mentioned about how a lot of these companies wouldn't come there, wouldn't make the investment in the first place, so it's a good fiscal, this is exactly right. That's the reason we do it. But I don't think it's all bad to bring the special districts to the table and give them a say, since it is their tax dollars that you are deferring as well as the others. The other thing I would say is just the practical one about this bill. If we're creating new enterprise zones, the opt-out will only be applied to the new zones. And it will be, in effect, a pilot to see whether it is going to create the complexities and the problems they're saying. Frankly, I think allowing someone to opt out is less complex than negotiating those other payments, but that can be seen in practice. But the truth is that if a city or county doesn't want the local special district to opt out, they don't have to apply for the enterprise zone, and they will be no worse off than if we didn't create these new zones in the first place. And so just as the argument is that you're only deferring tax on an investment that wouldn't have been made, we're talking now about putting conditions on enterprise zones that we will not have if we don't pass this bill. So from my standpoint, it's hard to say that we shouldn't respect the requests of the special districts and give this a try. And it also has an advantage from my standpoint, and perhaps from Representative Dallums, depending on what the Economic Development Department does with these requests, of getting this moving ahead and getting this done so that there'll be more zones. And that's why I'd love to see you vote this out today. And if there's a concern about going to 10 rather than 5, I believe that simply by an interlineation on the bill, you don't have to do a full amendment, you can reduce that to 10 to 5 if that was the issue, and vote it out today and move it ahead. And I would urge you to use the draft 4 amendment as the tool, and I think there can be continued discussions with the cities and counties, probably not with me because they're probably not speaking to me anymore, but with others. But to me, that seems to me this is the best way to get this bill going and to do something that keeps faith with all the parties involved.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And Hasina Square, you have the last word. Could you come on over?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, without having seen the language that Ms. Penwell proposed in draft form, even as it went into LC or back from LC, I can't really comment on that. I would like to point out to the committee, though, that nothing prevents a business from currently, without statutory authority, from negotiating something with a special district or an actual enterprise zone sponsor, so it really would only be a matter of placing some language in statute the way I understand it, to allow a business to negotiate something in addition with a special district or a zone sponsor, which doesn't necessarily have to be mandated via statute. I believe that could currently happen, and it does happen occasionally with some of our rural fire protection districts when an issue like this arises. We support the Dash 4 amendments for all the reasons that I almost said former governor. former labor commissioner Roberts articulated. All right, I need to collect myself there for a moment.
You make some points, though.
ballots are secret, aren't they? Would urge you to send this bill to the Revenue Committee with the Dash 4 amendments as already adopted.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And so we have a Dash 4 amendment on here. I'd like to have a discussion from the members of this committee. What's the choices? And Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do support the Dash 4 amendment to this bill, and I think it's important to remember that when this bill went out of the gates, it was infinite number of enterprise zones. I think we've distilled it down pretty fairly with this 10. I would resist, although I know we're only talking concept because it's LC, I would resist going to that discussed amendment for a couple of reasons, but not the least of which is that we need to be bolder when we market the state, and I think infinite enterprise zones was pretty bold. 10 is good. 10 is something we can market. When we start talking 1 or 2, it in my mind defeats a lot of the purpose of enterprise zones, which is A, not only to have the enterprise zone, but B, be able to go around the nation and indeed around the world and say, hey, we've got this, Oregon is open for business. So once again, I would just reiterate, I think the Dash 4 to the original amendment is the best way to go at this point.
Okay. Any of these questions? It seems to me that most of the members looking at me that move for Dash 4. Well, are you sure?
Yes. I mean, no,
what choice do I have? Okay. All right. We have a Dash 4 amendment, and already we moved that. Okay. And so, I want to make sure that the members opposing and in favor of Dash 4 amendment say aye. Those opposed say no. Call the roll.
We've already done that.
We've already done that?
Yes, it's already attached.
Okay, there was a coup. We expected great resistance from the leader.
All right, and so those who are in favor of this 31,
will you need a motion?
Mr. Chair? Oh, yes, we need a motion. Thank you.
Before you move, let me mention that this at present this does not have a subsequent referral to revenue. It was one of the items that you discussed last time. We have, since you met last time, we do have a note from the Speaker allowing us to give this a subsequent referral to revenue.
Okay. All right, so Mr. Chair, have a motion then. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3143 as amended to the is it revenue or is it
revenue
to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Bruin moves the House Bill 3143 as amended and refer to the Revenue Committee. Any discussions? All right, and I do have some concerns of this Dash 4 amendment, and enterprise zones should be the way that without such so many opt-out, and I do have some concern. I just want to express that, and then since this is a limit to only new enterprise zone created, that's put me a little ease. And I hope this works well. And then we are going to look at this issue in 2 years when we come back and whether it's going to work well or opt-out clause will be a problem for the companies coming to that area. But as I see it, special districts, only they share only 10%. So it's not that large. But maybe process may take more time to do that. With that, and at least we understand the opt-out clause and some hesitations it might need in the process, but let's see what happens. Since the members of this committee supporting this poll, let's go ahead. So please call the roll.
Representative Gallo.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
I got two amendments.
Representative Nelson. Excuse. Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Chair Lim.
Aye.
The House Bill 3143 with amendment is passed. And then I'm going to close the House Bill 3143 as a work session. All right. And the next. What's the next one? 2143.
You have 2174.
21.
You might want to share it over with members, and Nelson is here for 3307.
Okay. We don't have the amendment for this one?
Correct.
Okay. I'd like to have a work session at 2174.
You want to have a hearing? Well, I'll just open the hearing.
Open the hearing on 2174. Explain to us what it is.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this bill, you've had in committee for a long time, and there's an amendment working in Legislative Council that wasn't quite ready yet. The original bill makes site preparation planning mitigation interest costs eligible for economic development project funding by the Economic Community Development Department. The amendment is probably what you would want to focus on, and I'm not sure it will be the dash 2. In your summary, it says the dash 2. And it is a restructuring of the special public works fund of the Economic Community Development Department. Mr. Salzgeber is here to describe it further if you'd like to call him.
Okay, Mr. Salzgeber, could you give us what's the possible another amendment? What's in it? Which one? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, good morning.
Yes, before you go on, let the Representative Nelson like to vote on House Bill 2143-4. I'd like to open a work session again. Vote aye?
I certainly do.
Okay.
Chair Lim, it's an awesome bill.
Right. And Representative Nelson votes aye on House Bill 2143 as amended. And I'm going to close the work session again, open a public hearing. And it's already open, so please go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Salzgeber with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. We would like to thank the chair for indulging us for these many months. We have had a work group which has included the counties, the cities, the special districts, and some other parties who have been working on a comprehensive amendment to House Bill 2174, which would amend the manner in which the Special Public Works Fund is administered. As our staff looked through the bill, or through the law, they found a number of improvements that could be made in terms of how the bill is administered. And in talking with our partners, the decision was to come back and propose, instead of some Band-Aid changes to the bill, a comprehensive streamlining of the statute. And we have not yet received the final Legislative Council draft back of the amendment, so we haven't even had a chance to look at what they are proposing. But basically, it would streamline the statute by repealing a number of provisions in statute that are no longer operative or that complicate the manner in which the statute is implemented, and it would make some other changes that basically just improve the administration of the law. So what we are doing now is waiting for the LC draft to come back to us, and as soon as our staff has had a chance to ensure that it conforms with the agreements that the multiple parties, many stakeholders, had in their discussions, we would like to come and visit with each of you, get you briefed, and then possibly bring this back on Wednesday if possible.
All right. Thank you very much. And so when do you think we can bring this bill back? Wednesday or Friday?
I think it should be this week. I think you post it for Wednesday.
Post for Wednesday?
And then, if things are not ready, we can carry it over to Friday. But we'll go ahead and post for Wednesday with your permission.
Okay. That's looking good to me. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And with that, and I will close the public hearing 2174, and then we will have a work session, hopefully, when everything is ready on this Wednesday. I want to know, dear members of this committee, we are going to have the committee meeting on Friday also, since this is the last week of the committee opening, so we are going to utilize a Friday if there is any business important we need to do.
House bills.
Mostly house bills.
Yes.
All right. And did I close this public hearing? Okay. I'd like to close the public hearing, House Bill 2174, and open a public hearing, House Bill 3307.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3307 eliminates the requirement that jobs made available to Jobs Plus program participants not displace regular employees.
All right. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I have been so impressed with the Job Plus program and have had to explain myself several times. Because my belief was, and still is, that if an individual can get their foot in the door, the likelihood of their being permanently employed is great. There have been individuals who said, you know, but they're not going to be working, you know, on a Job Plus program at, you know, minimum wage. And my concern is this, is that I think over my business career I've bound to have hired some thousand individuals, and many of them who had no idea that their skills would mesh with an aviation company. But once, for example, we got into proposal making, there were individuals who had that skill. There were others, you know, who could write. There were others who were excellent in public relations or contracts. So that's the reason I've been so supportive of Jobs Plus. However, in this bill, it was brought to my attention that the amendment, or the bill does not say what I had meant originally for it to say. It simply deletes the sentence. So Mark Kane is here today, and he's helped draft the amendment that will be used on this bill, so I hope you'll call him to speak.
I'd like to call at this time Mark Kane. Yes. Higher calling and public affairs, Klamath Fall.
Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
Excuse the dark glasses. I kind of had a bad day this morning and
that's all right.
Stepped on my glasses and oh, matched them really good, so I have a bigger version of the testimony. And I might be a little slower than normal.
We don't have a copy of the amendment, right? This is the concept.
Pardon?
Do you have a copy of the amendment?
I did not bring a copy of the amendment, but I'll discuss it briefly. It's been prepared by the council, and I thought you already had one.
Okay.
Chairman Lemon, members of the committee, thank you for today's opportunity to testify before you on behalf of House Bill 3307. I'm Mark Kane from Klamath Falls, Oregon, and I'm employed by Higher Calling Public Affairs. I'm testifying at the request of the bill's sponsor, Representative Donna Nelson. Since the session began in January, I've been meeting with legislators to discuss the importance of reauthorizing the diversion from the Unemployment Trust Fund of funds that would be necessary for the Jobs Plus program for unemployment claimants to continue into the next year. I've also met with many legislative staff, representatives of the Employment Department, at least two of the department's separate advisory councils, the staff of other departments that relate to the Jobs Plus program, including three members of the governor's staff, local administrators and staff, union representatives, and most importantly, with some of the participants who have benefited from the Jobs Plus program. The reauthorization of House Bill, reauthorization bill, is House Bill 3462, and will be heard on Wednesday before the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. It's not reauthorization that we'll discuss today. Today we are simply discussing an adjustment to the Jobs Plus program. I have suggested an amendment to the bill that would correct what I believe is an error on the part of legislative counsel in preparing the bill for its sponsor, Representative Nelson. It was not her intent to allow the placement of Jobs Plus participants to displace existing workers, as is indicated in the bill. An amendment prepared by counsel should correct that error. The bill you are hearing today, when amended, makes an adjustment to the present program and would subsequently affect the reauthorized program as well. It allows Jobs Plus participants to be referred to and fill existing but vacant jobs rather than the present program requirements, which require that Jobs Plus participants be referred only to newly created, never previously filled positions. It focuses the program on the placement of individuals currently out of work rather than on the creation of new jobs. I've considered all the facts gathered in my interviews throughout the session and have also applied the nearly 33 years of experience I have in the development and administration of employment programs for people with all kinds of challenges in finding and holding employment. Large numbers of people remain unemployed in the state of Oregon. And while some are celebrating the fact that the state's unemployment numbers are approaching the national average, I think to myself, why are we celebrating average? Where's the pride in mediocrity? And I am reminded that in some counties, the percentages remain above 10%. People remain in need of employment. Unemployment has a devastating effect on people and families, while employment encourages individuals and families to grow. Research from numerous sources reveals this. When employment is taken away, people become susceptible to depression, cardiovascular disease, AIDS, and many other illnesses. In fact, unemployment causes people to be twice as likely to become clinically depressed. Compared to those employed full-time, twice as many of the employed said they were currently drug users. A rise in unemployment of 1% correlated to an increase of nearly 500,000 crimes in the United States. And what about our children? Children whose parents are unemployed are at a higher risk of emotional and behavioral problems. The longer that conditions of unemployment lasted has been correlated to a decrease in the intelligence of the children of the unemployed. On the brighter side, researchers found these results. Parental employment reduced children's behavioral problems, increased positive social behavior, and improved overall children's health. In young adults suffering from depression, employment causes high recovery rates, and working is an integral part of treating substance abuse. So you see, it's not just about individuals, but about children and families as well. There have been complaints that the reemployment of nearly 7,000 people through the Jobs Plus program for unemployment claimants since its last reauthorization just isn't enough, and that the program ought not to be reauthorized. On the contrary, I was thinking more about the benefit to all the others as well. I was thinking that we get too caught up in statistics and not thinking enough about the value of each job, one person at a time, and all the people that each of those newly employed folks might influence. Individuals and families experiencing healthier lives because of employment and all its related benefits reminded me not only of the value of wages earned and the impact on the economy, but also about the value of services that would not be required. Services provided by other entities that consume state general funds. You have all sat through hearings with all the human services agencies begging for additional funds while you are looking at which services to cut. Here's an opportunity to reduce the burden on many of those other services and the need for additional general fund support with funding from another source. House Bill 3307 also takes that contrary but more proactive view and seeks to improve the program to achieve more placements and to lower the levels of unemployment. There should be no harm to anyone concerned to open this program to existing jobs that remain unfilled. I have followed newspaper reports about the economy over recent weeks. In February, the Oregonian reported that nationally employment had slowed to a crawl and that the percentage of those employed as a part of the labor force was at its lowest point since 1988. My first reaction was, well, what about Oregon? So a few days later, another front page article reported that Oregon was experiencing its highest level of employment in its history. That, however, was by raw numbers, as the rate of employment was still at 6.5%, a point and a half higher than previous session rates. And since I have read about job expansion in service industries, manufacturing, and more, some may tell you there's no longer a need for Jobs Plus as people are being hired. And I ask, who is being hired? Are they those with little experience and need for additional training, or are they those that appear to employers to be the most qualified? I interpret the news to say that the economy is growing and the time couldn't be better to get challenging employees on the job. But I also believe that employers won't take the underqualified without a little assistance. The employment of the most challenged will have the greatest impact on individuals, families, other service budgets, and the health of the community in general. We have an excellent tool to provide that assistance in the Jobs Plus program, and now we have an opportunity to enhance the program and open it to more placements than has previously been possible. Many jobs remain unfilled because there is difficulty in finding qualified candidates that are acceptable to the employer. If this is the case, it makes good sense to offer workers with some previous work experience, but who also need training to meet the demand of the job specifications. It makes good sense to offer employers assistance in training people on the job and meeting those job requirements. The Jobs Plus program offers employers assistance in the amount of $5 per hour for the first 13 weeks of employment, and following the first 30 days moves $1 of that $5 to a personal training account for that employee. You might challenge why you consider removing the job creation requirement of the present program. This proposed bill shifts the focus from creation to simply the value of work to individuals. But this isn't just about individuals, but about their children. This isn't just about individuals and children, but whole families. This isn't just about families, but about whole communities and the opportunity to participate and contribute to community life rather than to be perceived as a burden on your community. This is about the opportunity to support oneself, personal responsibility, and human dignity. On April 14th, I was visiting with some participants of the Jobs Plus program in Klamath Falls, and this is what I heard from one woman. She was employed by Diamond Supply 2 years ago and still on the job now almost 2 years after the training subsidy to the employer has ended. She couldn't say enough about the positive impact on her life. Without solicitation, she went on to say more. Part of her work assignment now is to be a mentor to other Jobs Plus employees who are coming into employment with Diamond Supply. She also spoke to the positive impact her employment has had and continues to have on her children. They have a different view now of the need for education and training and of the value of employment itself. She testified to the improved health of her family in general because of her own individual employment and its impact on others in her life. She accepted my being proud of her, but more importantly, embraced her own well-earned pride in herself. She and her family are on the way. She was just one of many who could tell similar stories. 1 in 10 of employed Oregonians will file an unemployment claim this year. That's a lot of Oregonians looking for work, and in many cases, some additional assistance to gain their reentry into the workplace. They want to go back because they know the best place to learn is on the job, and they know the value of work itself. One nationally known leader recently stated that there is no freedom if you cannot get a job. Let's do whatever we can to keep people working. Thank you, Representative Nelson, for inviting me to testify today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'll remain if you wish to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
So, Mr. Chair?
Hold on. Any questions? No? Yes, Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. That pretty good. My one concern, I like Jobs Plus program. I don't like this bill as written. I'm not sure about the amendment. My concern is how the jobs that we're going to fill became vacant and how long they were vacant, those sorts of things. And this doesn't, as far as I can tell, won't address that. And I'm a bit concerned about the possibility of making jobs vacant so they can be filled with...
Right.
With long term.
Chairman Lim, Representative Riley, I think those are legitimate concerns. I've discussed the potential abuse of the Jobs Plus program with field people when I was visiting in Klamath Falls and others. And in reality, I think their concerns relate to our suspicions that people will take advantage, and I guess some people do. In practical reality, what I hear from field staff is that doesn't happen nearly as often as we might suspect. When it does, they're generally aware of it, and they have the discretion not to use employers that they feel are abusing the program. So.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was, as a matter of fact, was going to explain that very point. If we rested for a moment, that's what I went to do. I can't believe I don't have the amendment here in my packet, but I will bring it for the work session if you decide we can have one. But I wanted to explain that there is an in-house self critiquing method of evaluating employers. And what we don't want to happen is, you know, a position to for them to let a $40 an hour man let go and, hire a $7.50 an hour person. And so in the explanation of the why, I think those strategies or those, rules are in place. If not, we could amend those through administrative rule. But my point is that here's also what's happening in the workplace. Just by changing one thing, for example, if an individual was responsible for preparing the Monday morning management agenda, for example, she got sick and tired of doing that, so she quit. What happens often is that that position is modified just slightly. So maybe instead of the next person still doing the management, they do the marketing department agenda, and then that accounts for eligibility for Job Plus. That has to be a discipline within the agency overseeing it, just like telling the truth on your adoption papers or anything else. You need to be fully truthful, and this program needs to keep integrity. But my point, once again, is get them into a job.
Right. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tell me, do we have a problem that you could illuminate for me with employers who are not currently able to fill open jobs?
I don't know what this... Excuse me, Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley. I don't know what the number of unfilled positions is. Statistically, I haven't studied that. I have heard, however, that from field staff that there have been difficulties of filling some job orders and that there have been delays in getting referrals to fill those job orders and that there's some suspicion that the delays have related to the onerous requirements, at least in getting referrals for this program, mm-hmm. because they have to be newly created jobs. So participants theoretically are not eligible to fill longstanding vacancies.
If I could follow up. I'm just concerned that we have so many programs in the state, including like WorkSource Oregon, the whole idea of trying to match employers with employees, that would kind of leave it available for a qualified employee to apply for a job that is a currently existing job. I'm just wondering why we would need to move in this direction with Jobs Plus, given that the state is already making efforts to match employees and employers in a straight free market way, as one would say.
I believe it's the Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, I believe it's the intent of Representative Nelson's bill to allow the filling of existing vacancies. And so, yes, my thought, I believe, that we're talking about vacancies that have existed for some time and have gone unfilled. And so if you have a job, you have an applicant that you can fill with this program, why not make the match? I'm assuming that the match has been attempted and it has been made in other efforts, and so if you have other people that could fill the position with a little assistance that might not otherwise be taken by the employer, let's go ahead and do that.
Okay, so. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Mark. And I'd like to call at this time Steve Lenning from Oregon AFL-CIO.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. The written testimony that's being handed out is from our president, Tim Nesbitt, who can't be here today, but would like me to just briefly go over it. It's our belief that the Jobs Plus program was created to encourage the creation of new jobs and, for unemployed workers, not to take advantage of jobs that are already in existence. And even with the discussed amendments, the Jobs Plus program would still do that. And so we're not in support of this bill, even with the amendments. We've seen the Jobs Plus program for more than 10 years, and we think that it's not as a cost-effective program, and we think that the other programs available through the Employment Department have done a better job in placing unemployed workers in jobs. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Manning, thank you for coming today. Do you mean by we do not think this program accomplishes its purpose? So what do you mean, and what evidence do you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, our belief was that the purpose of the program was to create jobs outside the market system, create jobs that do not already exist or will not be created through the market system. That's what we believe the Jobs Plus program was created for, with the subsidized workers, and we don't see it doing that in a very cost-effective manner. I'm probably not the biggest expert on our program. I think our president, Tim Nesbitt, who sits on the Employment Advisory Council, is better to speak to that than me. Thank you.
Follow up. Mr. Vang, perhaps you'll talk to Tim about the issue here, but you need some what I call actual factual contractual data. True evidence rather than us just say not cost efficient. If you wouldn't mind, if you can bring that, because I've not found it yet. And my concern is for the employer who has positions that may have been open, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months, and they have not been filled. There aren't particularly individuals seeking, those type of entry jobs. So for employment, do you think we should still leave those open? Maybe the employer would take a risk if there was an incentive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we're still opposed to this bill, even as amended. And Mr. Nesbitt will be at the hearing on Wednesday to discuss the diversion of unemployment insurance trust money to fund this program. And I'll make sure that he provides you with some information. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, any other person like to testify on House Bill 3307? And hearing none, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3307. Since there is no other business before us at this time, the meeting is adjourned.